Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Wednesday, May 10th, 2017, starting just after 4 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 109th episode of the show. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with astrologer Samuel Reynolds about his recent appearance on the new Netflix series by Bill Nye in order to defend astrology. Before we get started with the interview, just a couple of announcements about our sponsors and giveaway prizes this month. Our sponsor this month is a software company called Astrolabe, which produces an astrology software program called SolarFire. SolarFire is one of the most popular astrological programs on the market today and is used by many professional astrologers. The program covers the full range of astrological techniques, including natal astrology, synastry, electional, and horary astrology. It also provides tools from a wide variety of different traditions, from the Hellenistic and medieval astrological traditions to Uranian and cosmobiology. Listeners of the podcast can get a 15% discount on SolarFire by entering the promo code AP15 when purchasing the program through the SolarFire website. You can find out more information about SolarFire at alabe.com. Our other sponsor this month is the mobile astrology software app called AstroGold. AstroGold was made by the creators of SolarFire and is essentially the mobile version of the popular desktop astrology program. AstroGold features natal, transit, progression, and synastry modules, resulting in a remarkably comprehensive but easy-to-use app for doing astrology on the go. The application is clean, clear, and precise, and uses the latest Swiss Ephemeris and ACS Atlas files, ensuring that the charts cast using the app will be as accurate as possible. The application is available on both iPhones and iOS devices through the iTunes Store, as well as on Android devices by using the Google Play Store. For more information about the program, visit astrogold.io. More details about our sponsors and the giveaway we're doing this month can be found on the description page for this episode on theastrologypodcast.com. All right, with those announcements out of the way, let's get started with the interview. Hi, Sam. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Hey, so you've been busy over the course of the past year, and I was actually very surprised. So I think this just happened, a couple of weeks ago. Open up Facebook one day and you've posted a video or a photo of you standing, taking a selfie with Bill Nye and announced that you're going to appear as a panelist basically on this new Netflix series that he has titled Bill Nye Saves the World, which was released on April 21st, 2017. And you had a short segment. How did that come about, or what's the backstory with that?
So it actually started in October. We actually filmed it in October. And it came about because some of the people behind the scenes heard about the ESAR conference in LA. And specifically, I guess there was an article published in the LA Times featuring astrologers talking about the panel, in which you were one of the panelists. And so they started canvassing, they being from Bill Nye Saves the World show, canvassing and trying to get in contact with people who were at the conference. And somehow Shelley Ackerman directed them toward me. I talked to one of the people behind the show, and they were very interested in some of the things I had to say and had me come out and do a taping for the show. And that's pretty much it from October. And I pretty much had to keep mum about it until April, when the show would premiere.
Wow, that must have been difficult to stay quiet about it for that long. So when did you recorded it? In late October or something?
More maybe the third week in October, just before the fourth week, yeah.
Okay, got it. All right. And so, it's many people are familiar with, especially younger people are familiar with Bill Nye as a science promoter who's kind of morphed a little bit more into a skeptic and science promoter in recent times. And this entire series is largely about sort of skeptical topics or topics related to different things that skeptics deal with, as well as just general sort of promoting and giving a platform for scientific things and discussions. So on the Wikipedia description, for example, it says, quote unquote, the series focuses on science and investigates its relationship with politics, pop culture, and society. The first season explores topics such as climate change, alternative medicine, and video games from a scientific point of view, while also refuting myths and anti-scientific claims. So your episode, you actually appeared on season 1, episode 11, which was titled Malarkey. And it seems like the majority of this episode was focused on issues related to confirmation bias, which is one of the common skeptical criticisms or scientific criticisms against especially forms of divination such as astrology that are used to sort of explain why something like that could appear to work, but in fact, doesn't work. So, and you appeared, it was just like a short 10-minute segment that you appeared on, but it was with basically a panel with two other skeptics plus Bill Nye. And so it wasn't very long. And how much of like the final, you know, time did you guys actually spend recording it versus how much actually ended up on tape?
I think about, we did 13 minutes, maybe 3 minutes more than what you saw, or maybe even was a little less. I think they got most of it. There are a couple moments that I had with Bill Nye that weren't recorded. I guess, you know, they were gearing up, but yeah, I think they got most of it.
Okay. So it was a pretty brief segment, and I mean, there was a lot of quick exchanges and sometimes like interruptions and stuff. I mean, how did you feel like it went, or what was the feedback been so far, or what were your expectations going into it versus how did you feel after the fact?
Well, some people behind the scenes talked with me, and you know, considering that this was the 11th episode of the show, what had been observed is that Bill Nye, and it seems that there, and I haven't watched all the other shows, but it seems that with panelists, Bill would usually hang back. So the expectation would be that Bill would hang back and let my two co-panelists, you know, trade their barbs with me, and that maybe Bill would guide it along. So he was portrayed as more of a moderator, or that he would be a moderator. I had my hunch that that may not be completely true, because I, you know, considering what you read from Wikipedia, I kind of, as an ex-preacher myself, I see Bill Nye as still an evangelical for quote-unquote science. And maybe, you know, evangelist might be the better frame, but there's still evangelical spirit is still his zeal there.
Yeah, I think science evangelist is probably, you know, not even a label that he would reject, but I mean, they literally labeled his show Bill Nye Saves the World
Saves
under
the
that,
world,
that premise.
Right. So I actually had some reservation about how much you'll hold back, but, you know, I was going by what you know, folks who seem to know the show better would think. Well, that anyone who watches the show will know that that didn't happen. Bill was very much involved in the discussion, maybe too much so. And so I was a little disappointed that it did become 3-on-1 and that there really wasn't enough time for me to explain. I think I had the assumption, an erroneous assumption, that Bill would ask questions and give me space to answer. I probably would have been a lot more froggy, you know, in terms of like jumping in and a lot more, I wouldn't say cantankerous, because I didn't want to come off, you know, aggressive on his show, but I did want to come off clear, and I would have probably been a lot more assertive or active. But I was like, okay, he's going to ask questions and maybe reasonably expect me to answer, but that's not quite what happened.
Sure, sure. So yeah, I thought we could talk about it, do sort of a overview or a recap a little bit of some of the exchanges that happened and maybe some of the things that, you know, astrologers could learn from it or could take from the whole experience.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, I felt, you know, these things, as I said in the forecast episode, I think a few episodes ago, these things rarely go well for astrologers. And so when I watched this, I wasn't expecting it to go that well. And I didn't feel like it did ultimately, although I was happy that they chose you, who's actually a professional astrologer, and this is your full-time profession, versus, you know, sometimes there's been other episodes of different things where they just grab, you know, some random astrologer who it may or may not even be their primary focus in life, or they may not have been doing it for that long. And it's just that becomes the stand-in for, you know, somebody that's supposed to be representing the entire astrological community. But at least with you, you're somebody who, you know, this has been your primary profession for quite a while, right?
Right, exactly. And I was glad it was someone from our community, of, you know, visible member of our community. I mean, not that it was just me, but someone who is still present within the community of astrologers and can talk about astrology, you know, I hope I did intelligently.
Yeah, I mean, well, ironically, the last time you were on this show, the first time maybe, what we talked about, the title of the episode, and episode, actually not even sure what episode title it, or what the number was, but the title of the episode was Responses to Common Scientific Criticisms of Astrology, where
sure.
You and I did that double header where we wanted to do, originally it was going to be one show, but we ended up breaking up into two, and one was talking about astrology and science, and the other episode was talking about astrology and religion. So it was kind of ironic that you then ended up being the spokesperson for astrology on this episode or on this panel with Bill Nye.
Well, it's not that ironic in the sense that, you know, one of the things that I have benefited from being on Twitter and social media is I've talked to a lot of skeptics over the years. And so I knew that there was a risk of going into the lion's den. I did expect the lions not to be the same great number. You know, maybe I expected one or two, I got three.
Right.
But, you know, even the particular tack I took, even though I do subscribe to it, I also knew it would be harder for them to process, which I think sort of proved true. They were just ready for me to kind of to go like, well, no, astrology is a science, and seem like Yosemite Sam and rootin' tootin' shooting in the air saying like, it's a science and I'll fight you in an alley for it. And I knew some of that would defang them in terms of where they could go. I know you have a particular view on that, but I also knew that the argument usually shifts when you don't take the claim that it is decisively a science. Yeah, I won't steal any of your thunder, but I know what could come next. But that's I did have that knowledge, or at least the idea. One of them would be like, it's a pseudoscience.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure it's like we had talked about some of those different responses, you know, that you can have to common criticisms, because the criticisms are pretty standard. I mean, that's one of the things you and I noted, is that a lot of the same criticisms have been around for a while, because what's common in the skeptical community is that in almost every instance, and this wasn't, this panel was no exception, the people that are sort of protesting the most loudly against astrology, or the skeptics that are saying things against it, are typically not people that have much background in the subject, but instead they're sort of skeptics of many different things, and they have a sort of somewhat shallow understanding of a number of different fields and what some of the common stock arguments are that, at least on the surface, appear to be relatively straightforward or rational arguments for why some subject doesn't make sense, or why it shouldn't work, or other things along those lines. And so because those same arguments have been sort of recycled for decades now, it's relatively easy to anticipate some of the things that they're going to throw at you. And he pretty much did right out of the gate, where
absolutely.
Let's see. So the focus of the panel was pseudoscience. And so Nye, basically right at the beginning, he threw out a few different statements right from the start, which kind of confused the discussion. So he opened up by saying to you basically that he said, you know, I don't believe any of it. And he said, do you know why? And then he sort of goes on this string where he introduces three different points, and he says, it just never has anything to do with anything. So that was point number one, or that was an argument that he was sort of making or trying to make, but didn't articulate very well. Then he moved on to point two, and he said, you're telling me that there's only 12 types of people, and that's something that you guys would come back to later. And then he moved on to the third argument in the same sentence, where he says, what about the wobbling of the earth, and what used to be a Sagittarius is now a Capricorn, referring to precession. And somehow this led to a few comments about Ophiuchus and the 13th sign that didn't really go anywhere. But it's like right off the bat, sort of you had to contend with three completely separate arguments against astrology that were sort of being thrown at you. And it was interesting because one of the things you did, and I could see that you were trying to do it, was you were trying to sort of disarm him by being casual or being sort of playful in some sense, it seemed like, right?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't feel the need to be, because I couldn't take, you know, what's interesting, even though those were the three arguments and they came so rapid fire, in a sense, it's like, well, do you expect me to take that seriously? me? Are you going to? I wanted to figure out his tone. So there was no sense to me to come off aggressive or match his banter from the gate for a couple different reasons. One, I think that would have been the expectation. I mean, if I were in his position, I often think, you know, from my opponent's position, I would want to see someone get riled up, because then that's a complete suggestion of losing control. Mm-hmm. So one thing I was clear on was not losing my head and not control. And one of the ways to kind of sucker a potential debate partner is to be a little more casual, especially in the beginning, in the opening, because you want to, you know, we're all starting off as friends, and this is a, this can be a cordial discussion. So I was hoping more for a cordial conversation, and I didn't take his arguments seriously, because he actually hadn't come with anything, you know, meaningful. He just came with three darts, and I was expecting, like, okay, are you going to come to a central point, maybe? And I think that's really hard for him. I think now looking at, now having looked at it a few times, I don't think he ever really came with a clear focus. I think, you know, one thing I'll say, I think some of this got edited out. I think Timothy Caulfield, who was the Sagittarian on my right.
One of the panelists.
Yeah. I think he had maybe even, it's been edited out, some better questions and thoughts. Jamila Bey, who was one of the other panelists, I felt like she was more into the banter. And also, she also, interestingly enough, got really off topic. So it was more like joke rather than really kind of trying to get into something substantive. And I was hopeful. But if I got really like, well, no, blah, 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 you know, I mean, you can always say like, I could have, should have, would have. But the one thing I probably would do differently is I probably would have still kept up some measure of the banter, but I would have shifted the topic and say, like, well, let's talk about this. And I think that's where I could have been a little more assertive.
Yeah. I mean, I think I understand why you did it that way. And even the show itself has this kind of casual or joking sort of vibe. And of course, you're on a panel. And I think that is a good strategy to not appear overly aggressive or defensive. But at the same token, you know, he was making some pretty strong criticisms and pretty strong attacks on you and, you know, by extension, the rest of the astrological
sure.
community. And so there were some points there where I definitely felt like I wish that you recognized in the moment, like what he was saying and how, you know, sort of insulting it was in some sense, and responded to it, not by, you know, being a jerk to him, but being a little bit more serious about, you know, directly responding to some of those criticisms and, you know, refuting them essentially.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ones that I'll just tell the audience, you know, both my wife and I bristled more so hearing again, like, you make a good living, don't you? And of course my wife was like, well, yeah, kind of, no. So, you know, and she can testify more than anyone, you know, like how much of a quote unquote good living I don't make in that sense, which is not to say I'm not, you know, living. And even when he said you make a good living, I make a living. But, you know, when he was going into that, I think probably I should have wrestled, you know, a little bit more with him and then saying like, well, you know, if you're making the implication that astrologers, you know, are fleecing people and making a huge profit. I don't know any astrologers like that. But I thought he was going to ask me a question, or he was really asking, but it was really just more rhetorical, you know, sidebar.
Yeah. I mean, most of it was statements. I mean, because he opened up earlier in the show, or at least what is the beginning of the episode and the final finished product, you have to kind of contextualize the entire episode and what happens on the panel with a couple of statements that he makes at the very beginning, where he said, and this is before you were, you know, on the panel, he said, quote unquote, charlatans use confirmation bias to sell us nonsense. And once you buy in, that same bias will keep you in the dark. And then he goes on later and he says, quote unquote, people take your money often when you're the most vulnerable, when you've had a death in the family, when you're concerned about something, and that's when they prey on you. So it's like, that's where he was coming from later in the conversation. When you get on the panel, his point is, you know, A, what you're doing is bogus, and B, you're ripping people off. And those are sort of recurring themes for him that he, I mean, in fact, in his very opening questions, so the first time he really gave you a chance to speak, he looks at you and he says, but what's your deal? And he says, quote, you don't believe it, you know, by that he's saying astrology either. So he's basically, he opens it up by saying, you know, what's your deal? You know that this is bogus and that this isn't a valid phenomenon, but that you're just using it as a way to rip people off. And he's basically asking you if you acknowledge that. And then at this point, you sort of respond and you continue to try to be a bit disarming and respond by saying that you use astrology, but that you think that it's like a language. And you say right from the start that you said you don't believe that astrology is a science. And then when they ask, of course, you know, then what is it? You say, quote unquote, it's an interpretive art. And then you quoted at one point Shelley Ackerman saying that it's, quote unquote, the marriage between math and myth. And so this is our first sort of point of discussion, or maybe our main point of discussion, which is that part of the strategy that you went for in this panel was to take the tack that astrology is not a science and that it's a language, in order to sidestep this, in some sense, this issue of their accusations of it being pseudoscience or not scientific or not valid. So why did you take that approach? Or I'm trying to think of how we should frame this discussion. I was kind of, you know, disappointed in that in some sense, because I felt like by saying that you were fundamentally or for all intents and purposes, just acknowledging that, just conceding the point or almost agreeing with their point that astrology has no actual validity or that there's no truth to it, but then instead you see it as like entertainment or something like that.
And I appreciate your honesty. I mean, that's something that you and Kelly and Austin talked about a few weeks ago. And Austin had some thoughts as well, you know, and questions about science. So I think that's a good segue for me to talk about what my intention ultimately was. So I do believe that. Someone even asked me privately, another astrologer asked me privately on Facebook, was that really a chess move?
Right. Well, yeah, because that's an immediate question. Is that just a rhetorical strategy that you're using, or do you honestly believe that there's no, because it appears to be that you're saying there's no validity to astrology?
I don't see that just as equal to that, right? But so the answer is, if in answering that, both to you and to what I said to the astrologer, it is both. So the chess move is, I anticipated going into the lion's den that, you know, and I, like I said, I always think in terms of my opponent's perspective, you know, well, they're expecting me to defend astrology as a science. And I don't, and I have never to date or my knowledge ever purported astrology as a science in all the years I've been studying and teaching and using astrology. Having come from a social science background, you know, study science as a central focus in high school, I know that astrology doesn't usually fulfill the demands, the needs for replicability, the needs for control groups, all those particular aspects that, it, you know, astrology struggles with that. In terms of looking at it as a language, and I know you felt like my response my response about it's like Hamlet is bogus, and I want to explain that. I mean, it's all related to that sensibility. I don't think when we're talking about art and the importance of how we know things, that becomes a statement of it not being valid. In fact, it can be even more valid. And I think that's what we should be challenging science on the most. And when I said to Bill Nye, and this is where I felt like I wish the conversation had gone deeper there, and maybe I would have been a lot more aggressive and assertive in this particular point, when he said, you know, I can show you things that science has discovered and we see through science that essentially, to paraphrase, are beautiful. And that's the point where I said, but will it provide meaning? And human beings need meaning. This is where I have the fundamental problem with our vested interest, whether I say R as astrologers or R as a collective society, our vested interest in scientism. And scientism, just to be clear for your audience, is the idea and the belief that science is central to the understanding of all human knowledge. And the scientific method is the means, and empiricism is a means by which we can rightly understand human endeavor. And that's a lie. most of what we have valued in our culture, most of what we value in terms of the construction of our society, doesn't have to be literature, but let's be clear, we made it all up. The sexagesimal system that we use, even as we're registering, how long are we going to talk for this podcast? An hour and a half, 60 minutes. There's no empirical evidence for why we use it that way. None. Or why today is a particular day. It's all kind of fabricated by a notion of how we've conceived of time, how we conceived of the experience of anything. So when I talk about it as an art, I'm actually subtly saying that on some level, you know, we're not Homo sapiens sapiens. We might be Homo sapien or Homo fabricus, where we make up things. And I think that is unsettling to the mindset of those who've kind of bought into scientism and science, because like we believe that we're discovering the world as it is, not recognizing that we're discovering the world more as we've created it.
Yeah.
The culture.
And that was in the discussion we had prior to this episode. That was the point that we started talking about, because my issue was I felt like you were conceding that there's no objective validity or reality to astrology by saying it's purely an art. And your sort of response was partially that you don't personally, in your personal philosophy of life, don't think that there's any such thing as an objective reality at all. And so that's where you're coming from partially with that argument.
Yes. I would say that there is an intersubjectivity, right? And that is used in epistemic terms to mean that as much as I might say there's no objective reality, which is not to say there is no reality, there is a reality by which we have constructed. So for instance, if you say to me, as you have, that we're going to talk for about an hour and a half, I will not have the expectation that, you know, I'll be talking till the sun comes up. Right. I mean, unless we were talking at that late, which we're not. So there's a construct of time that we've agreed upon and that I've learned and that you've learned and we can jointly understand. And so if someone were to ask me, well, there is something empirically as 60 minutes. Yes and no. I mean, more so the no is that another culture, another time could easily, you know, another place could easily conceive of an hour in a completely different way that we do. In fact, we know for a fact that's true. Anyone who studied planetary hours knows that an hour doesn't have to literally be an hour.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take that to some extent, but to some extent, I don't think that that's an argument that's not going to work in that format in terms of if you're arguing with a group of scientists and you try to say there's no such thing as objective reality, that's not going to go over. It's not going to win anybody over, convince anybody for one, but for two, there are, you know, different cultures have developed independently different, you know, measurements of time, like the year, which is the amount of time it takes for the Earth to go around the sun. I mean, that's an objectively measurable form of time measurement that.
Well, they have and haven't, right? I mean, like there are ways in which we've conceived of the idea of the year in completely different terms, you know, and with, you know, whether they're like the solely lunar calendar or it's an intercalary set of days as the Egyptians had, or there's intercalary days or even exceptions of time that's even used, or even different years that's even used like in Ethiopia. Ethiopia doesn't even have the same year. It's Muslims don't even use the same year. So you're right. There is a way in which we've had a meshing of culture, even the sexagesimal system that we use. Originally, you know, coming, as you know, well better than I, coming from the Babylonians, we've adopted and has been adopted from cultures for over 2,000 years. But that still doesn't mean by virtue of that becomes something that is objective. I mean, that goes along to the same frame where, you know, Jungians believe like, well, there's something empirically that we can call archetypes. I don't know if that's true. I think it sounds metaphysical.
Yeah, I mean, well, maybe let's bring it back to one of the points that he made. So you make this response that it's just an art, and then the conversation continues and he responds saying, so what service do you provide to people with your quote unquote art? Mm. And you say, I use the cultural imagination of what we know as astrology to talk to them about how their idea of themselves based on their chart, their birth chart syncs up with their life experience, basically using biography. And then he interrupts you and he says, in other words, you get them to tell you stuff about themselves and then you reinforce it with these astrological things in the background. So he charges you with cold reading, which is one of the common sort of criticisms of astrology. And I don't mm-hmm. think you quite responded to that, but you tried to go back to your previous point saying, you said, quote, no, it's actually about using the language of astrology as a means of talking with them about or dialoguing with them about their lives and about themselves. So it's a language. So, I mean, there's a real issue here where he's raising the point that what you're doing is just cold reading and that you're just picking up statements, you know, about the person, that because you're acknowledging astrology doesn't have any objective validity and therefore doesn't have any objective truth to it, that a person's birth chart, you know, doesn't actually have any relevance really or explain anything about the person in any objective sense, that you're in fact just picking up things from the conversation and then using that to give the appearance as if astrology says something. And my issue with the tack that you took in that argument is that you're almost kind of acknowledging that by saying it's an art and saying that it has no objective validity. You're saying that you're almost just using the chart as a jumping off point for counseling or for the dialogue without the astrology itself having any sort of truth to it.
Well, let me ask you a question. When you say the astrology having truth to it, what do you believe? Do you believe, and if you, it sounds like you do believe it does have a truth to it, which I can agree with, but why?
Because
why? Is it metaphysical? Where does that come from?
Because there's an observable correlation between celestial movements and earthly events.
I agree, but why?
Well, no, you don't. If you agree on that point, then you would agree that there would be some objective...
Here's the correlation.
Then you would agree that there would be some objective validity to astrology, because there should be no correlation in objective reality between celestial movements and earthly events.
Well, I think there's a reason why, but I want to understand your perspective why. Maybe it might be, since it's your show, I mean, you can come to that when you want to, but my perception of it, I believe that the correlation that we observe about it, and this is going back to someone else who has appeared on your show, Jeffrey Cornelius, I believe the reason why we have a correlation between the heavens is not because the heavens bespeak something independent of us. I think it's because of the significance that we've assigned to them.
Right.
I don't think it's something independent of us. I don't think it's something independent of our conception of ourselves and constructions of our culture over time. So, I mean, you could look at that correlation as a way in which we see and have constructed a partnership between our projections onto the heavens and our conceptions of what happens on Earth.
I think it's probably a mixture of both, and that it doesn't necessarily need to be all one or the other, but that there can be some objective validity to astrology where different cultures could independently observe the same things, you know, regardless, or something could be happening independent of culture. In addition to, there could be ways in which culturally astrology is relative, or our conceptualizations of astrology are, you know, outgrowths of the culture or what have you.
Well, see, and I'm glad you brought that up, because this is the conversation you and I can have because we know astrology, right? And here's where I'm going to take on the reign of a skeptic of sorts. Because I can say, and you, now I know you've studied many different cultures and histories of astrology. The question becomes, independent of the interpenetration, let's say, between the Hellenistic models and, let's say, from the Babylonians and from the Greeks, is what you're saying true? Did multiple cultures come to some of the same similar conjectures about the heavens without this cross-fertilization? I mean, Aztec astrology is very, very different from the conception of Western astrology. Chinese astrology and its conception and its use is very different. So where's the data to support what you're saying?
I think it's hard to say because most cultures had some interaction, and so you can't study them completely independently. But in, for example, the one that you mentioned in terms of Mayan astrology, they ended up focusing on the Venus retrograde cycle as being important and seeing that as something notable. But so did, you know, different astrologies in Mesopotamia and in the Greco-Roman period that developed independently also found that to be a useful cycle, and in some instances did interpret some parts of it very similarly. So to me, that's evidence of some sort of external validity of astrology.
Right. We can say that we can objectively, I'm not saying that the planets don't exist independently of us, they do. So, I mean, the cycles of the sun as we perceive it from the geocentric perspective, that's true. But as you just said, I mean, there's some parts of the Venus cycle that Mayan astrology, Mesoamerican, we might be able to say better, devised, but they had also a very different conception of Venus than maybe even what developed in Hellenistic or even from Babylonian conceptions of it. And definitely in terms of what happened in terms of the conception of Jupiter in Chinese astrology is different from the conception of how we use it in the same way. So the question becomes then, well, is there really an underlying pattern of consciousness and ideas in astrology as astrologers purport? And I think that's where it shows more so. There's a cultural framework that, you know, has been infused and then cross-fertilized with different cultures over time. But is there something beyond that? That's where I would question just by knowing sure. the history of astrology. Because there's no, you know what I mean? It's not the same empirical.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a whole other sort of topic that we'd have to deal with, because we'd also have to be much more well-versed than I think either of us are independently in Mesoamerican astrology in order to make a full comparison.
That's fair.
But let's see. So moving on, Bill eventually asked, he interrupted the third panelist at one point, because after moving on to the next panelist, after you gave your response, he basically said, he looked a little unimpressed, because basically the way you're framing astrology as having essentially no objective validity, but just being something like a mode of using language for counseling, it didn't really counter his accusation of cold reading. So that kind of went unchecked. And so then it came to the next discussion point, where he interrupted the third panelist as she was introducing herself, and he went back to you and he said, "Can you make a prediction?" And the point of that is that they're trying to bring it back to their core point of whether there's any objective validity to astrology, whereas you're saying essentially that there doesn't need to be, or sort of sidestep the question. And at that point, you redirected by saying that, you know, you said, "Sure, I could make a prediction," but then you said, "You don't think that every aspect of knowledge needs to be replicable." And Bill responded quite rightly saying that it does in science. And Sam, you responded saying, "Is all knowledge sequestered to science?" And there's sort of this back and forth. And this is where Austin's point from the forecast episode is kind of relevant, where he pointed out that basically the word science is being used as a stand-in or a substitute at this point for truth. And that's one of the issues I have in terms of taking that tack with them, is by right out of the gate saying astrology is not a science, that's, as far as they're concerned, that's basically the equivalent of saying it's not truth or it's not valid. And I think what you were saying that was accurate as part of that is that astrology or astrologers do not use the scientific method, and they do not put proper controls or experiments oftentimes in terms of how they develop techniques or come to conclusions or certain things. But I don't necessarily think that we need to go as far as saying that it's not a science in the broader meaning of the term, as a sort of field of knowledge that has some validity or some external truth to it.
Well, see, that's kind of the thing. I mean, well, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I mean, I don't know if you finished your point.
No, that was it. I mean, was it really necessary to go as far? I understand that it almost puts you in a better position rhetorically if you just agree with them and say it's not a science, and therefore the label, so that's fine. You almost agree that it's a pseudoscience on some level then, but is it necessary to go that far to say that it's not a science when they're essentially using the term science as a stand-in for something that is a valid phenomenon?
Two things and two levels of responses. Well, one, I'm really, really glad that Austin said what he said, you know, a few weeks ago in terms of looking at science as a stand-in for truth. But I'm going to go even a step farther with that particular statement and realize that we astrologers have not realized fully. I mean, in our pursuit for over 100 years, maybe even starting from Alan Leo, right, to somehow gain the trust of the public through acquiring some dimensions of the trappings of science, by also adopting, you know, some of the principles that have been outlined by science in terms of astronomy, like including the outers as rulers. I think we have done ourselves an immense injustice, because we haven't really seen where the war and I'm going to frame it that way just for a rhetorical level, where the war is being waged. And the war is that science and scientism has hijacked the very notion of where we experience truth. And I think me kind of stepping into, you know, the lair that way and saying like, oh, well, because I can get the reading and I get what you're saying that, oh, well, you're seeming to acquiesce to their claim that that you know there's nothing true about astrology. What I'm really saying is that you don't have a province on the truth. The only way by which we can understand truth is not just through science. And I think to see the collapse between truth and science is to kind of buy into scientism's claim that the only way by which we can experience truth is through science. And I don't believe that at all. I don't think you do either. But in the question that you're framing, it almost seems like that. And I think that is a common idea among many astrologers. So we have to realize and challenge how science has really laid a claim on truth. But there's a deeper issue. The second layer of this is realizing that we've kind of lost control of how we talk about our notion of truth. And when I say we lost control, I can go to something very forthright. Astronomers will find new planets, name them, and then name them inspired by myths, right? Eris or Quaoar or all these, Setna, right? And they will come up with these names, and then we will look at the myths, we being astrologers, and then we will kind of assign a whole mythos and an astromythos based on the names that astronomers have given it.
And we've talked about that before,
but that's a relatively
recent development, I feel like, in a history of, I know we've argued about this before, but like that's something that's really become, even though that's commonplace now, we have to be careful because that approach may be much more recent than astrologers realize.
Define recent.
Like the past few decades of astrologers taking.
What about Pluto?
Well, Pluto didn't really come into widestream usage until like the 1950s and 60s. But prior to that, like Uranus, for example, we have evidence of astrologers who are studying that empirically.
We have evidence of one astrologer, right? You mean Varley?
Yeah. Well, one influential astrologer who took notes, who studied it in charts over and over again and made empirical observations. And so he wasn't just going from the mythology and saying Uranus indicates this, because even if you went that way, one of the points that Richard Tarnas has made is that the mythology of Uranus, of Ouranos, doesn't really even fit with, you know, the significations that astrologers give to that planet. So there's
But realize what that blows up, okay? And so it blows up even the aspiration, you know, and this is what is always mind-blowing from many of my students. The description and how we've understand and assigned rulership, even from the classical rulers, and you know this as well from, you know, your book and the work that you've done, is more inspired by the geometrical and even the geometrical layout of time and space of the Tema Mundi, right? Which is very different than, you know, the assignment of rulership that came about because of what, you know, we talk about affinity. So that's a different issue. But in terms of like the signification of the planets, that comes from something that's a lot more both intuitive, and then as you said, there's at least one astrologer who came along an empirical set of ideas with a planet that was named Uranus that, as Richard Tarnas says, may have been misnamed. But that's one. That's not science. That's not something that goes along our traditional notion of science, you know, to talk about one astrologer.
Well, and that's
the same thing for Neptune.
That's a sort of
the same issue for Neptune,
right? I mean, it's
right. I mean, empiricism and science. So I think that gives astrology, whether we want to acknowledge that or not, a leg up on pursuing a different aspect of knowledge or a different pathway to knowledge that is not just embedded in empiricism. But yet and still, we want to lay the foundation of the development of our art on a certain different field. On science itself, we're not making, you know, and staking our own claim in our own field. Now, I've posed this to other astrologers, and I think, you know, going back to Geoffrey Cornelius, he had an interesting answer, which kind of surprised me. You know, this is where he kind of went into his own, I want to say, metaphysical idea. He was like, well, we tapped into when scientists named these planets, They may be tapping into a collective consciousness by which we have given, you know, that we can use the names that are given that do kind of meet and correlate to a societal need. I kind of don't know what to do with that because that's not even the history of our field.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of tricky just because there's a lot of things going on there when you're talking about the discovery of the outer planets and societal changes are going on and how that developed, especially because astrology was going through that low point after the 17th century when it sort of died out and fell out of the universities and modern science was, you know, sort of growing and being developed and established, while at the same time, things like astrology were falling by the wayside.
Right. And we haven't come back. So to go back to my original point, that low point is still there because we still have a certain beholden sensibility to science without challenging it on its terms, like that it has exclusive province toward the truth. It doesn't. And I think it is high time for us to say there are different ways by which we can understand human experience that are very distinct from empiricism and very distinct from how we know knowledge. I mean, it's one thing, yes, to say it's art, but even in art, there's ways in which we can understand things that are experiential, that at the same time have a consensual reality that we can understand that's not the same level of empiricism. It almost seems that any aspect of human endeavor that engages behavior runs into this problem. Psychology, economics. What's amazing to me is that people can get degrees, a bachelor of science in economics, and there's nothing scientific about economics. Nothing.
Yeah, I mean, and that is a broader issue where that's very clear in the social sciences, that there's certain things like with psychology that are hard to validate through the scientific method or can be more tricky to validate, that still may be valid, you know, forms of knowledge or valid fields that can be helpful or can be useful or effective, even if they're sometimes difficult to pin down. But, you know, that's still, they still acknowledge that there's aspects of that that are valid or are empirical. And I mean, I want to push back on that a little bit because astrology and astrologers to me are highly empirical. I mean, we're constantly looking at and observing different correlations between, let's say, placements in a person's birth chart or certain transits, or like a Mercury retrograde happens or something like that. And astrologers will note that and they will write it down and they will like add that to a collection of observations and data that they're building about what types of things happen in the world when that astrological correlation or that when that placement takes place. And that on the one hand is, you know, even though that's not, they're not doing it, astrologers are kind of lazy or kind of sloppy in some sense, in that we don't typically apply the same constraints that would be necessary within the context of the scientific method to make it as clean as it could be. There's still an empiricism there, and there's still an assumption that there's something objectively out there that's happening.
Yeah, well, that's not. But if you listen to what you just said, I mean, literally thinking as a scientist, it comes out the same. You literally just said almost nothing, in the sense that what I would say is not that there's empirical data, there's anecdotal data. And I think that's fair. And I think anecdotes have meaning and have purpose. But empiricism, there is a certain regimented rigidity to it that and demand of it that astrologers, as you just said, don't meet.
Well, there can be, but there's different levels of that, depending on how much.
But where is it? I mean, like occasionally we have it, right? But even when we, and what's interesting is that when we do, and this is where the work of David Cochrane is very interesting and other harmonic astrologers, when we do get into big data and looking at the collection of data, it looks very different than how we normally talk about astrology. And this also goes into the heart of other things that we believe or we talk about. So for instance, I was just having a discussion on Facebook with someone who seemed, you know, hell-bent on believing that astrologers had empirical reasons for why. So for instance, Venus is the ruler of Taurus or the ruler of Aries. Now, you and I both know from reading Ptolemy and other sources, there's no collection of data that's been that for why planets were assigned rulership. I mean, it's basically on the theme of Mundi, and it's more geometric. It has nothing to do with a mass of data for rulership. But he was intent on really thinking like, well, there must be some data. And the idea is that, oh, well, Venus must behave better in Taurus, right? Or Mars must behave better in Aries. None of that's true.
Well,
but it's anecdotal.
I mean, astrologers widely believe that that is true, though. So you're actually
Do we have empirical data that's true?
Yes,
we have anecdotal data.
We have empirical data. What you mean is we don't have scientific. We have not applied the scientific method consistently in order to prove objectively and without a doubt that above a certain that taking a certain sample size that there is a greater right. than percentage than chance that would show that Venus does X when it's in certain signs.
Correct.
But that's different than.
But that's anecdotal. That's not empirical.
Well, that would be
anecdotal.
Scientific, but.
But we don't have that.
It's still a type of empiricism, even if it's anecdotal.
That's fair. And we do have anecdotal. I mean, we've had anecdotal for thousands of years. I mean, we have, whether we're talking about Mashallah, whether we're talking about Ibn Arabi, whatever astrologer we're talking about, they have stories. They have anecdotes. They have particular even principles, you know, whether we're talking about Banati. Specifying particular things that mm-hmm. happen. So, but do we, and of course, when we look at Lily, what's great about Lily and what we love about Lily is that we have the charts and we have the stories, even when the charts are off.
Yeah, he has chart examples to show his empirical studies of astrology.
But you're using that word. I don't think it's empirical. I think it's anecdotal, which doesn't mean it's not valid, but it's not empirical.
I mean, I'll look, I did some other definitions that I wrote down in the notes, but let me look up. So the Google definition of empirical just says, quote unquote, based on, concerned with, or verifiable by observation or experience rather than by theory or pure logic. So the idea is that you're developing information on something or you've come to some conclusion based on observations rather than just, you know, theory or logic. And to that extent, when astrologers have case studies that show like Valens did in the 2nd century or like Lily did in the 17th century, when they show hundreds of different example charts, that is a type of empiricism where they're trying to demonstrate their conclusions through example charts.
Right. But in terms of how we talk about empiricism and science in the modern sense, we don't have that fulfillment of it.
Yeah.
And that's why I would prefer anecdotal.
Well, I'm not going to concede that point and call it anecdotal. I'll say you are right that astrologers, when they're doing their empirical studies, do not typically apply the scientific method, and they don't do it because the scientific method has certain tools and certain restrictions and ways that certain things are supposed to be done in order to eliminate potential like false positives and things like that, or. But, issues like confirmation bias, but just because astrologers do not apply the scientific method consistently does not mean that part of what they're doing and part of the way that they develop knowledge is through empiricism.
But I guess my point with that, I mean, there's empiricism in art, you know, I mean, there's empiricism, or I could say there's the idea of the empirical, as we were talking about it, in all dimensions of human endeavor. And that's the problem with empiricism. It kind of reduces and doesn't recognize, you know, there are aspects of human endeavor that have used some of the same ideas. Even the scientific method is used in all aspects of human knowledge and has even been used in astrology. It's just not used with the same rigidity and the same claims. And scientific method really even comes more out of a religious background. It comes from the work of, you know, Francis Bacon and Alhazen, you know, from other thinkers dealing with optics and trying to figure out things who didn't have this antithetical basis of, you know, mixing theoretical, you know, deductivist models or deduction models with more, you know, experiential or actual fact. So it was really the challenge to see what is God's handiwork through actual observation. And then, you know, control groups and all these different things that we've developed has become something more that's developed over time. So, I mean, that's one thing to appreciate. The scientific method didn't start off with the same rigidity that's come to be. And that's important to look at the history of science itself and recognize that what science has become is not what it's always been. And what that really highlights is that there's a different notion of truth, and truth is always evolving. And I think, you know, I think actually Austin even made that point, you know, because I mean, as we talk about racism, there are people who did actual studies who concluded that races and certain things are real and that there's actual empirical data to say, like, well, this race is inferior, without really, and I mean, they had their own confirmation bias.
Yeah.
So I think, and I think why I'm getting into this is really recognizing that the quote anecdotal, even though I know you don't want to use that phrase, but even life experience, the counting of living through a moment, the experience of something, you know, being moved by something, which is why I make the correlation to Hamlet and art. These can be valid on their own. We don't need objective truth to be the only basis by which we understand something as valid.
I mean, but astrologers don't largely. I mean, that's the objection I would have is that the way that you presented it like that, that astrology is like Hamlet or like a work of literature, like 99% of astrologers do not believe that astrology is just fictional or can be likened to literature, because they do think that it's objectively true, that they do think that the sign of the zodiac Scorpio, for example, has some certain qualities or properties that can be observed in different individuals when they have different placements in their birth chart there. Or they do think that when Mercury goes retrograde or Venus goes retrograde, that there's some observable period of time that will coincide with certain things that will exist there. I mean, and that's, I think, the issue. I understand where you're coming from. And I think to your credit, the metaphor of astrology as a language is one that's been around for thousands of years. But I think you're going too far with it in presenting it in a way that's, I'm not even sure that that's true in terms of how you practice and believe in astrology, because you still treat it like it has some objective truth, even if you're saying that it doesn't here.
Well, I think it has objective truth in the same way, you know, that we might talk about literature. So, for instance, let's talk about that. Caesar was real. How we understand dimensions of the story of Julius Caesar and the Ides of March, some of those actual, from historical detail, we do have access to. But a lot of it was embellishment. And I think the embellishment, the fiction of even biography, which is 99% of the case in almost anything we watch about a person's life, some measure of that embellishment exists not so much because, like, oh, we have to have the truth, but we have an approximation and some means of the experience of the truth, which I think is valid and important. So when astrologers say, well, there is a correlation between a Venus cycle and what happens on Earth, here's what astrologers also don't say. And this is where skeptics usually fail, because they don't know what astrologers say. But this is where I can be the a-hole and say, like, okay, this is what astrologers say. Astrologers will say that it means X, Y, or Z. It also could be where it could be X prime, Y prime, and Z prime. There are other things that might manifest that puts it within a range of interpretation, not that it spells out particular things. And I think that still is cultural, because you could talk to someone from a different culture and they have a whole different measure, or may not even use the same measure, for a planet or how something may happen. It also brings up an interesting question. You can use different metrics or different variables in different aspects of astrology and somehow come upon a different or come upon a similar answer. I can go to a Vedic astrologer who will talk about my Aquarius rising, which means it has a different ruler, and still have resonance with something about my personality, as versus going to a tropical astrologer, Western astrologer, who will talk about Jupiter as my ruler. Who's right?
Right. Both. I mean, that comes down to two separate issues. I mean, one of the issues that you're talking about is the overwhelming complexity of astrology, and that's one of the issues why there is an interpretive art to astrology, especially at this point in time, because when people ask, you know, why don't you just computerize this or something like that? Could a computer do the same delineations? That there's a level of skill and there's an additional factor that goes into it, because there's so many possible variables that there is a judgment call that takes place at different points in terms of how to combine those variables into a delineation that's going to be accurate and consistent. But so that's a separate issue. But then there's another separate issue of, I mean, what was the point you were just making? So you're talking about the complexity on the one hand, and that being an issue for astrologers. And then the second point was what?
The variables. I mean, the fact there are different metrics that you use. that can come up to the same.
Well, I mean, that's just more of this broader issue in astrology about can there be different frames of reference that can still be valid, even if you're looking at it from different perspectives or you're using different tools. That does one tool set automatically, does that make it sort of mutually exclusive so that having one approach works, makes it so that other approaches don't work? Or, you know, that actually brings in, because then the common answer to that, or the one that I've talked about on the podcast, that's a good way to conceptualize what's happening there, is the astrology as language metaphor and why different traditions of astrology can work as if you have different languages that can still be valid. And just because French works doesn't mean that German doesn't work or is an invalid language because it approaches things differently. But that's separate.
But that's still, I don't think it's separate. I think, you know, it's only separate if you have this faith, this hope that there can be an objective aspect of that's separate from the languages that we use. And on some level, to some reasonable level, there might be a little bit, but not as much as we would like or hope. I mean, like, so for instance, what's interesting in terms of language is it deals with the conception of it. For instance, I can say in English, I'm hungry, right? As versus I say in Espanol, yo tengo hambre. I mean, I have hunger, which is a whole different conception of how we talk about hunger than how it becomes in English.
I mean, is it though? I mean, or is it just different ways of doing, of saying this, of conveying the same meaning?
In nuance, I mean, as an English speaker, it sounds the same because it's like, oh, okay, that's what it translates as I am hungry. Whereas to say I have hunger means that I don't become the state. You know, that's what's interesting about Spanish, for instance, as an example in terms of dealing with language. There's two different verbs for to be. There's ser, right, to be, and estar, right? So one is transitory and one is more fixed. This is not something that happens in the same way in English. So there's a whole different set of being. And, you know, one thing, you know, I told you I was inspired to watch Arrival, thanks to your show with Adam Ellenboss, because you guys were talking about it. And I'm really glad I did, because that movie does touch on this very same issue, that your conception of language or dealing with a language rearranges your whole perception of time, space, and how you live your life. Now, it's a movie, but I think there's some essence and truth to the experience of it. So I think there's some culturally derived aspects for how we approach something. And I think that's true in astrology. But for astrology to say, like, no, we transcend the idea of language and we can come to an objective reality. I'm sorry. I think that's a delusion. And I can press any astrologer at any point, including you, that you won't be able to fully demonstrate that as true.
Well, okay. I mean, but I want to say that just to bring this back around to the sort of focus of the Bill Nye episode, I think 99% of astrologers would disagree with you. So to the extent that you were taking a tact that is an outlier or is very unique from the astrological community of in terms of how you were presenting astrology and saying, it's not a science, it doesn't have any objective validity or truth, I completely concede all of the points that you guys are making about it essentially right from the beginning, I don't know that that was an accurate representation of the astrological community. And that's a little bit problematic to me.
Well, but that's not, but that, but at the same time, that's not,
well,
what I
it's
said.
What they heard. I mean, if you go into a science show and you say there is no validity to astrology by saying it's not a science, it's just literature.
But that's not what I said. I didn't say it didn't have any validity. I think literature has, I mean, immense validity as a human endeavor and source of knowledge. I mean,
well, they wouldn't deny that, but when they're using the term science to mean, is it valid? And you say, no, it's not a science. You're saying it's not valid.
But that's where I think we should challenge them, Chris. I mean,
you can't in a 10-minute show. That's the problem.
That's fair. I mean, I willingly would concede that. I mean, like, you know, if you're saying that I probably should have said and used the word validity more than science,
yeah,
I would
if
agree
you say,
with you.
If you turn around and say, if by that you mean, do I think that astrology has no validity and yet I still practice it and apply it to client charts, then no, the answer is I think it is a valid phenomenon and that I'm helping my clients and the people that I teach astrology to. And I personally believe that this is a valid, you know, form of study, however you want to contextualize it.
Right. And I agree with that point. I mean, my My point, though, to flip it with that, is though not to singularly believe that science is, as I asked, the only way by which we can understand the validity of human endeavor. And I think you're concerned about that's the only way they can hear it. I think the key thing is recognizing they're not going to hear you. I mean, as a skeptic, they're not necessarily going to hear you if you say it's valid. You could say it's valid until you're blue in the face. But the only way by which they measure validity is through their understanding of the scientific method. And what's fascinating to me is that it's often the people who are not scientists who take this hardcore approach. Bill Nye is not a scientist. As much as I don't know even if Neil deGrasse Tyson is practicing as much as a scientist. I think they become more evangelists. Any scientists I've talked to, what has been interesting is that they recognize the politics. They recognize the other things in science that have nothing to do with science. But there's a certain purity that people who advocate for science insist on, and they often talk about any means of validity is through something that's testable and replicable and replicated in a lab, which is exactly what Jamila said, which was fascinating because she's not a scientist. She's a reporter. So I think as much as you can, you know, pull me on the carpet gently, as you have, that I could have talked about validity, have no delusion to think that if you had gone on that show and talked about, I think it's valid as a source of knowledge, that they would agree with you.
No, of course they wouldn't. But I mean, I think you have to still do it and you have to go through the motions, because his follow-up questions then, one of the later questions he asks, he says, but here's my thing. Quote, astrology makes no provable predictions. In fact, in our opinion, it's a little bit of a waste of time. But then he turns to you and he says, but you make a living on it, right? And then you say yes. And then he says, you make a good living because people come to you for advice. Right. Is that right? And then you say yes. And then it didn't really, there wasn't any response there. Because on the one hand, it seems like you're conceding that there's no truthfulness to it. And then he allows then to push his next point, which is that there's no truth to it and you're charging people for it, which then by implication, as he said at the beginning of the show, means you're just ripping people off.
Well, I mean, he had an agenda, and his agenda was not really to interview his guest. So, I mean, that's where I would put the fallacy on him. I understand where you're coming from, and I could have, you know, the argument is valid to say I could have been assertive and said, no, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, at the same time, I think where he is going to bear the brunt of, you know, maybe some pushback is not, you know, he didn't give me a chance to sensibly answer because he didn't really ask me a question. Whoa. He was leading a witness, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, he was giving leading questions, I guess. And just the purpose of this discussion, and just to provide a sort of statement about that, because I didn't at the beginning, I mean, we're friends and I wanted to talk with you about this to give you a chance to expand on some of the points that you made in the show, to talk about the areas where it went well and where you did a good job and where I was happy that you represented us, but also to talk about some of the areas where it's like I disagreed or I thought it could have been better. Sure. Or, you know, where we could have grown and learned from it. But the point of this discussion is to help other astrologers and us as a community to have these discussions with skeptics and with the public in the future by, you know, really having some of these internal debates and getting things worked out so that we can be, even if we don't
sharper.
Agree, yeah, sharper and just more effective at presenting what it is that we do as a community.
And that's why I'm really grateful for the opportunity to come on your show. And I think, and I take it as a debriefing. And, you know, even my best friend came at me and was like, he was disappointed by me taking the stance of it as not a science. He couldn't articulate as clearly as you have why he was disappointed. But I think those are valid things to kind of bring up. And, you know, there's some points in which I, you know, felt like I wish I had been a little more assertive here and there. I mean, especially at that particular point where he was going with that leading the witness, and you know, I was really expecting another follow-up question where he would allow me to answer, but that was my mistake, rather than seeing like, okay, well, this is the trap. So I fully agree with you that's where I missed an opportunity, but I thought it was an opportunity that would come not because, you know, I didn't see, you know, some sense of what he's doing. I thought he would give me the opportunity to address it. I thought he would be a an honorable host.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just important to understand where he's coming from is that he thinks that people like us, that we don't believe in astrology, that we think like him, that it's completely bogus and false, but that despite knowing that, that somehow we still try to make money from it by seeing clients and from, you know, using other alternative nefarious means like cold reading in order to rip people off. And from that perspective, part of what he's trying to do is expose you or expose us as doing something that's not only harmful to clients, but that's harmful to him for the entire world, because he actually concluded the entire segment with a statement to that effect. So at the very end, he randomly transitions into talking about climate change, which it seems like it has no relevance to the discussion, but it actually becomes relevant because he says, my claim, this is his last statement, he says, my claim is that lack of discipline, lack of searching for true cause and effect is inherently bad. He says, it's bad for you that just moseying around trying to figure things out and claiming that there are connections which are provably unconnected is troubling for us on the skeptical side. You know, and then he applies that to climate change, where he shows how, you know, people denying climate change or going against the scientists who have demonstrated that this is a valid phenomenon, how this is having real tangible negative effects on the world. And he's transferring that to astrology and other things that appear to be not sciences or anti-sciences or pseudosciences in some sense.
Yeah, yeah. But one thing I do want to bring up that's a counterpoint to some of what you're saying is that one anecdotal piece I have to share, which could be empirical. I mean, I'm just having fun on that level then. But is one of the writers who is, I'll just say, someone who is viewed widely as a source for science and a scientist himself, did come to me privately afterwards and said, thank you for coming on. You gave me a different perspective than I expected. And I actually will have to think more about it. And what's interesting is that the same person talked about looking at the Cassini probe and some other discoveries that have come up about Saturn and was inspired to take a symbolic view of a discovery. I believe it was with one of the moons, and used that to extrapolate the significance of that discovery to something that was happening on Earth. That's astrology. And he talked about it. And I was like, that's amazing. I mean, I don't know if he recognizes it as astrology, but that's kind of what we do. And I think it did reach him in that sense to realize that, you know, when we talk about celestial poetry, and that's straight, you know, I have to disagree with you. I don't know if it's 99%. You've had people on your show. I know Jeffrey Cornelius, right, who has said almost exactly verbatim what I said. I mean, like, if I framed astrology as like even celestial poetry, that's where I got that from, by the way. If he said that to once, he asked the skeptic once, if I said that to you, what would you think? Or what would, he's like, I wouldn't have any problem with
that. Because you would be conceding the point that it's not objectively true.
Well, but that doesn't mean, that's where I think you have a limitation. I don't think it means that it's not true. I don't have any hope of objectivity. But I think it can be true in a way that poetry rings true. And there are people who read poems, you know, I read and I'm moved by, you know, particular poems, whether you're looking at Emily Dickinson, and that's why we've kept them for hundreds of years, because somehow they resonate and ring true. So, I mean, this idea that it has no objective measure or intersubjective measure of validity, I think is erroneous and too fueled by scientism.
Well,
and it's empiricism.
So I will go, the one guy did, I will take your side to make an argument more in your favor for a moment, which is, I can see, you know, where this, I feel like this originated or where parts of this thinking came from is that there's some astrologers like sun sign astrologers like Rick Levine, for example, who, when he writes his, you know, horoscope columns for each of the 12 sun signs, he, you know, sometimes says that these are partially to be viewed like that there's an artistic or a poetic element in there. And that even though he's only using one part of the chart and therefore acknowledges that it's necessarily incomplete or only partial, or that it's only going to apply to some people, that there will be some people that it does really speak to, you know, on certain days. Or when somebody like Michael Luton writes a column like that, when he writes like a daily or a weekly column where he invokes, you know, art and myth and other things in order to invoke what some of the planetary weather is or what some of the alignments are that are relevant to people at that time, there's an artistic element to it. But I just think we need to be really careful about taking that argument too far, especially with the public, and pretending that that's all that it is or that that's all that we're doing, because, I mean, there's so much more to it than that, to almost reduce it down to that this is the same as literature, or that this is the same as a novel like 50 Shades of Grey or something. Like, you keep using Hamlet as an example, but I'd almost like to use something more like, you know, contemporary in order to really drive that home.
What do you mean, like Hamilton? Or like, what do you mean contemporary?
Well, something that's not based at all or connected to a historical event. Because when you say literature or novel or a play or something like Hamlet, that's what a normal, like a scientist's mind goes to, is something that's just fiction that somebody just came up with off the top of their head, because that's what they already think that astrology is. So when you say that it's like literature, they think, well, you know, 50 Shades of Grey, or they think, you know, what's that? They think that the Twilight novels or something like that, or Harry Potter. So you're saying like astrology is like Harry Potter?
In the sense that it's literature, right? But I would say that, you know, Harry Potter is also something like life, but it's also the same as like how we might look at any particular piece of, you know, thing that we might read in terms of literature, whether we're looking at the biography of Winston Churchill, even that's been well researched, right? There's some parts of it.
That's nonfiction, though. So you're switching. Can't switch genres.
Well, I can, but here's the interesting thing. You read any historical piece or any tale of a life, and I'm sure you have. Have you done readings on multiple stories of someone's life?
Yeah.
There's some points where it really lines up beautifully, and there's some, by virtue of research, there's other things that are put in that don't line up. That's one.
But they're writing about like an objective person who actually existed.
Right. But that doesn't mean, by virtue of the reading of it and then what is put in it, right, in terms of the story and the arc, that isn't, you know, some measure of either embellishment or how you create the arc of a story. It's not, it's still story making. Wow. It is still, and that's kind of the problem that we have when we talk about literature. Literature doesn't have to be completely, as we describe it, fictional. I mean, there's even aspects of, you know, things that are non-fictional in terms of literature, in terms of, you know, even a novel. You can read a historical novel. There's some measure of embellishment, but the fact, you know, like I read Nietzsche Wept, which is using historical characters, but the arc of the story and how it works, that's fictional.
Yeah, but there's certain things, if you're talking about a biography, that aren't, that all the biographies are going to use, that Einstein was born on a certain date and then he died on a certain date, that he released his paper on relativity, you know, on a certain
date. True. And so there's astronomical data that is verifiable independent of anything we might say about it. But the moment we start talking about significance and meaning, we've gone beyond the idea of just what can be completely verifiable as data. Well, the same thing with Einstein. It's one thing to say Einstein was born, you know, as the, you know, I think he's the second child of a particular family. It's another thing to extrapolate from that. Well, Einstein felt, you know, really, you know, he was troubled by his relationship with his sister, blah, blah. You would only have to have that from data. And even if you extrapolate it from the data, that would be your conjecture, which is what biographers do all the time.
Well, there's some level of conjecture, but there's some events that happen in a person's life. If somebody goes to jail during their Saturn retrograde, I mean, that's an objective event that occurred with an objectively occurring astronomical phenomenon. And that doesn't require any interpretation. And there's astrologers out there like, you know, our friend Nick Dagan Best, who really thrive on that, just pointing out correlation after correlation with celestial movements and events happening in people's lives, and then not providing any interpretation, but instead just letting the correlation speak for itself.
But the correlation doesn't speak for itself. But the correlation, it has significance because we know the language, right? And also, the correlation is not what has caused the event, right? It's right. Using the word, And we've learned enough to say even the word correlation, because, you know, astrologers have struggled for all of our history between, you know, even the use of the word influence, you know, because this is something I wrestle with every day in terms of, you know, when I talk about on Twitter or I'm talking about horoscopes, are we talking about causation or correlation? And so there's some that would have argued that, well, he went to jail because of his Saturn return, which is not generally what we believe.
Right.
So it's still a challenge for us. And correlation doesn't mean then that that becomes the absolute manifestation of the story. There are plenty of people who've had Saturn returns. And one of the things I appreciate about what Lisa's work is doing, Lisa Skeim, what her work is doing is trying to figure out, you know, we're looking at Saturn by virtue of its sect can give us an understanding of about the nature of your Saturn return. Because why is it that some people have Saturn returns that are abysmal, right? And others is like, well, I don't remember what happened at 29 or 30 at all. But I mean, they had a Saturn return, but the significance of it is not, it's not something that they see as unusual. Like, oh, but talk to me about 23, 24, my Jupiter return. Oh my God. Moron, that was like amazing. That was crazy.
Right. But that, I mean, that varies based on the birth chart. And then her argument with the sect thing is that there's this objective variable that if astrologers take it into account, they'll see that it's applying very consistently among every Saturn return chart that you're looking at, that there's a distinction where people who are born at night tend to experience that period of their life in a way that's more challenging versus there's people who are born during the day that don't experience that period of their life as challenging. And then she backs it up by showing a bunch of examples to show, you know, from client files and from other research that she's done, how that works out in practice. So again, it's trying to take something that's an objectively occurring phenomenon of was the person born during the day or were they born at night, and say that that actually has some objective validity in terms of how that person's life goes and the events that take place during the course of it.
And I think, and again, I think that objectivity, that empiricism is useful. I look at it as more, using the word you don't like, anecdotal, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have validity. But to say it's empirical means then, you know, well, first, I'll go with the dictionary definition. It is observable. I'm not going to argue that. But it's one thing to say that the correlation leads to a consistent measure of behavior that we can kind of give a number to, like it's 85% statistically true, it's 65% statistically true. We don't know. We haven't done that data. We don't know the research. We haven't constructed that level of research. So to kind of say then this is something that we can be consistently true, the only thing we can talk about individually, what we've done as astrologers, is talk about what we have found. And this is, and I know you probably have had this gripe too. Many astrologers have had the gripe. You know, you go to a conference and someone has discovered a particular, and I'm not saying Lisa's in this category at all, because I actually have looked at it and found some correlation too. But there are people who also find work or do work and they come up with their own pet theory on how things work based on observing charts and come up with a method associated with that that doesn't work consistently for anyone else.
Right.
So, I mean, and this is something that we've discovered even with classical methods, whether they're from the Hellenistic period or even as they're working with, you know, in terms of the, you know, the medieval period. Okay. So there are many people, without kind of isolating them, who are sold on Fedaria, for example. I have tried variations of the Fedaria system because I learned it with Profections. And I've tried various forms of using the Fedaria with different charts and clients, and it doesn't work as consistently for me as people who work with it love it. It just doesn't happen. Now, does that mean the system doesn't work? No, I wouldn't even go that far. But I do think that sometimes in the way that we don't fully understand, there's a subjectivity to our experience of method that isn't as empirical as we would hope.
Right. But you arrived at that. And I don't disagree, because I think there is a hugely subjective element. And I also agree that astrologers don't put the controls in place when they do most of these experiments or these attempts at empiricism in order to make it truly scientific using the scientific method. But it's really important to note that your conclusion, the way that you came to that conclusion, was through an empirical approach of testing it out on your own and deciding you couldn't get it to work well enough. Therefore, you would not continue to use that technique, whereas there's other
techniques.
Right. So That's really.
That's empirical in the level that we both know from the dictionary is observable.
Yeah,
which we agree.
But that's really crucial because I feel like if you had said that to them on this panel, that would have been much more compelling than saying it's just an art, which to them they think that means you're just coming up with it off the top of your head, because typically artists are inspired. It comes from a place of inspiration rather than purely a place of developing something based on testing.
Well, I mean, the artist does come with a sense of method, right? So, I mean, there is a sense of discipline and method by which they approach their inspiration that is still observable in terms of effect. And the effect usually is to please the artist, but it also could be to please the audience or to please someone who kind of registers with it. So, I mean, that goes back even to, you know, I mean, I'm reading this great book, I'm sure you're familiar with, and I'm blanking on the title of the author, but Influences, which is looking at the astrological idea of art through the Renaissance, and particularly Renaissance thinking, or even more antiquity in terms of Neoplatonic thought. Which, I mean, have you heard of this book? Do you know what I'm talking about?
What's the title?
I'll get the author's name in just a second. That's the great thing about doing things when you're near your computer. But, you know, one of the things that it really talks about is it isolates the idea that perspectivism, when we learned about perspectivism in art, that really comes out of a certain kind of thinking. The method by which we construct perspective, you know, in terms of like how you might look at a building or side of a building, is based on the conception of using the rays. And then even using the idea of rays with the planets in that thinking, and from that particular history, you know, from Ficino. And the book is Influences, Art, Optics, and Astrology in the Italian Renaissance. It's by Mary Quinlan McGrath. She is not an astrologer. She is more of a historian. So not even more, she's not an astrologer. So, I mean, what it does lay bare is that even the idea of method in art doesn't mean it's divorced from a certain, you know, as you're framing it, empiricism, from a certain kind of, you know, way in which we kind of detail things.
Sure. So this leads into one of the other discussions, one of the last discussions we haven't covered that took place in the panel, which is there was this exchange where at some point Bill says to you, he says, well, no, because it was leading in from the previous discussion about it not being a science, where Timothy made this point where he says, what's interesting here is that he's providing a service to people that think that they're getting something from him. And that builds on something you said earlier, he's talking to Bill, which is these cognitive biases we have that allow this kind of pseudoscience to thrive. And it is the causal illusion, right? That he makes some kind of prediction, something happens, and some have suggested that that kind of causal illusion is the foundation of pseudoscience. Whether you're talking about Wi-Fi causing cancer, whether you're talking about this kind of phenomenon referring to astrology, or whether you're talking about any other kind of, and then you turn to him and you interrupt and you said, what is the first thing I said about astrology? He responds and you said that it's not a science. And then you say, there you go. And then he says, I'm going to come over to your side a little bit here. And he says, I like the fact that you're saying that it's not a science, because Bill, I think a horrible trend that is happening is that people are claiming things like this are science. So I don't know. It's just, it's important because, so, and then it goes on eventually and Bill interrupts and he says, of what use is it? And he says, that's what I'm saying. And you respond saying, it's the same use of any kind of art. It touches the imagination. It touches the human heart. People can relate to some things that are said through astrology, just like they relate to seeing a film, just like they relate to poetry. It's celestial poetry. It's seeing the stars come alive as it relates to your heart. And then Bill responds saying, I have to say that as a scientifically literate guy, or I try to be, when you realize what's really happening in the universe, what's really happening in the cosmos, it's far more inspiring. And then you guys go back and forth about that. But I mean, it really just, you know, raises those two points, which is just when you say it's not a science, they think you're conceding the point that it's not a valid phenomenon that's actually occurring in the world, which they think then just confirms your point, their assumption, which is that you are ripping people off deliberately. And then two, this other side question about, you know, some of the skeptics and some of the science promoters are trying to do this thing I've noticed recently, because it came up a few times, like in the Cosmos series, of trying to reframe science and skepticism and scientific promotion as being, you know, beautiful or illustrating the majesty of the cosmos without needing to resort to what they see as negative things about science and superstition and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the problem, you know, if I ever do come on that show, and, you know, Bill, as I mentioned to you before we started the show, sent me a note and was like, I have questions next time I see you. And if it's not on the show and it's just like somewhere else, you know, I doubt if it'll be on the street, but if it is somewhere else, where I would challenge him, especially is on that last point. And I have heard, as you have, but not necessarily just from Cosmos, from other things, where there's this belief that, you know, science is doing far more good than most other things. And it provides a lot more context and, you know, beauty is one of the things, but utility, you know, one of the key arguments that people will always, will frequently make to me is like, well, you know, you should thank science for your ability to be able to type on your computer or your technology, which is really fallacious. I mean, it's mostly fallacious because human invention has been around for pretty much as long as we have. So the inventiveness that we have is not exclusive to science. And in fact, we've actually stumbled more on things from even a certain lack of science rigor than we have from science rigor. I mean, we've done a lot in the last 200 years, but we can't negate the fact that it's predicated on knowledge that wasn't arrived at by scientific means. I'll give you a very specific example that we know from astrology, the doctrine of signatures. When we kind of can correlate particular shapes of plants and qualities of plants, and we assign particular meaning to them based on our understanding of the planets, and then would take certain plants like nettles having an association with Mars and the hot and dry nature of them. That wasn't from scientific experimentation or control groups. That was really inspired thinking by analog, which has been most of our history. And I think that really does bespeak a point that, you know, scientists and scientific evangelists really miss. They think that, you know, looking at the Hubble telescope and looking at the wonders of different, you know, nebulae, I mean, those things are beautiful and I'm appreciative. They're on my screensavers. I love them. But to think that that could supplant the beauty that you come from looking at your life through the lens of astrology, I can't see how that's any comparison. They're delusional. That's wrong.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't have any problem with the point that they're making, that there's something majestic or beautiful about the cosmos. And I can understand the perspective that they're coming from.
Well, I didn't disagree with that. I mean, I agree. I just don't think that's enough to think that, oh, well, we don't need to have specific other meanings from astrology or quote unquote these pseudosciences looking at tarot or any aspect of art. I mean, they're actually saying somewhat dangerous. They're trivializing other aspects of human endeavor, like art, and saying like, well, science really is the majesty of all human endeavor, because look what it can do in terms of giving us the cosmos and curing diseases and all these other things. Not recognizing it's not literally these, you know, ways in which you can connect A to B. It's the journey between A and B that's most inspired for human endeavor. I mean, we can't lose sight of that, as astrologers especially, because we can get lured into that trap.
Yeah, I mean, and there is a certain, I mean, I guess then that's how, you know, scientism is usually defined, as like Google defines it, as the excessive belief in the power of scientific knowledge and techniques, or sometimes the over-application of science to areas where it doesn't do as well or is not as appropriate, like philosophy or religion or in some instances sociology or other things like that.
And don't lose sight of the fact, Chris, that's the show I went on. The name of the show is Bill Nye Saves the World. So, I mean, I get what you're saying, and I think that is, you know, many of the criticisms that you've levied are fair in terms of, you know, certain ways in which I could have tweaked the conversation or been, you know, differently prepared. But at the same time, recognize that scientism, does have this perception of itself that really doesn't make much allowance for anything outside of itself, really.
Yeah, well, and that's fine. And I guess that's an argument or that's a discussion that could be had. I think it would have been more productive to answer some of his criticisms very directly and to counter them very clearly, to say, no, I do believe this is a valid phenomenon. No, this is not something I'm primarily doing just for money. And no, it's not even something that I make a lot of money off of. I do it because I am passionate about the subject, because it actually seems to be a valid phenomena in the world. And the fact that that works at all just blows my mind is amazing. And so I wanted to direct my life towards studying it and using it to help other people, even though it's not something that otherwise, you know, makes me a rich person or a super successful person or what have you, to, you know, respond to. And you did respond to one of his criticisms. It was probably your best exchange that you had with him, where they start going back and forth. He starts going back and forth with one of the panelists at one point and joking about sun signs. And he responded really briefly saying, but that's not astrology. Astrology isn't just reducing people to 12 signs. It's looking at the complex relationship between the planets. It's looking at the complex relationships between the signs. And then you said people read their horoscopes and think, well, that's all that astrology can do, but that's just entertainment. And that was a really great exchange, because that's one of, you know, his presumptions, and that's one of the ways that they try to portray astrology, because that's largely all they know about it, is that it's just this very simplistic thing that reduces people and carries all of these problems along with it. But even just pointing out that that's not the case is like really important. So sometimes I feel like with these exchanges, it needs to be more about, right out of the gate, just addressing the criticisms head on, versus trying to critique like their entire worldview or something like that, that's not going to necessarily be an effective strategy for trying to approach the subject. And in some senses, some ways it might backfire.
That's reasonably fair. But the question I have for you, which is where I guess we've had the meat of our conversation, would be what really does become the better tack, not just for these people, right, being the scientist evangelists, but even from a genuine perspective, because what you and I have gone back and forth about is there a way that astrology, as it purports, taps into an objective truth? And I'm a skeptic about that. I don't believe that is really ultimately true. I think we are the machination, we're part of the machination of culture. And, you know, astrology is not clear even on its own workings. You know, the base level of astrologer, and I'm talking about this in terms of thought, not in terms of, you know, where they are in the pecking order of astrologers, is to think they kind of have a pseudo mechanistic view of the cosmos. Like, well, you know, the moon, you know, affects the tides and works on us, so the other planets work similarly.
Right.
Which becomes laughingstock for anyone who's scientifically minded at all. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So that's one element of it. Then there's the metaphysical element of it, like, well, the planets are alive, and this goes into Platonic, Neoplatonic thinking, right? And then the other one, you know, dimension of it is it goes more metaphysical. Is it something that is more tied to some theosophical thinking? You know, maybe even how we have drawn in some thinking from, you know, Vedic thinking, karmic, and the other aspects of it, which is more Jungian, Freudian, that dealing with human impulses and archetypes, and particular archetypes have us. So the mechanisms of astrology are, in terms of how it works as this quote-unquote objective measure, are suspect. When I say suspect, meaning like, well, even in our community, we're not clear. So I think, I guess I was coming in, I hear what you're saying, like, for these people, you know, they're not going to be satisfied with this the other way. So it is important to have a certain melancholic, dry approach and say, like, no, this, and this, and these factors. I hear what you're saying. That's fair. But realize, too, when I talk about astrology as an art, I am also saying a statement about even our conception of astrology. And maybe that's where we differ, and that's fine, and we'll go back and forth about it. But I think it's important to start having a conversation rather than assuming we're all on the same page, even at the 99%, which I take issue with. I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
But that's fine.
Well, I mean, part of it is just, I mean, there's such a lack of standardization in our field because it fell out of academia and because it's largely studied by hobbyists and studied as a side thing rather than a primary profession. And it's not taught, and there's a great deal of disorganization in the field because it exists on the outskirts of society. I mean, to me, that's why a lot of that stuff that you bring up is almost like byproducts of that, of the societal status and the low status that it has in society, why more astrologers aren't on the same page about certain things, or why there's so much, not just diversity, but there's so much disorganization or disunity when it comes to certain things about the theosophical or the philosophical and technical principles of astrology, is a byproduct of falling out of high society a few centuries ago and never really recovering, except in pop culture where everybody knows their sun sign, but that's all only one small piece of astrology. But I think if you'd come in and just said to a group like that, there's this incredibly weird phenomenon where for some reason there appears to be an observable correlation between celestial phenomena and earthly events. We don't fully know why that is yet, but it seems to be something that different cultures have been observing for hundreds of years now, while astrologers have not done a very good job so far of demonstrating the validity of this in a scientific context. It still seems to be something that's deserving of further study. Most of the arguments that you've put forward here on this show demonstrate a lack of familiarity with the subject, or at least a familiarity with only the most surface level sort of consumer version of astrology that there is. And I think that instead of continuing to argue against it and put out these somewhat shallow arguments against it, despite not having learned much about it, that it would be more useful to look into the subject more earnestly to see if there's anything there of value. And if there is, to, you know, help us to explore it further so that we can eventually take the parts of it that do represent something valid that could expand scientific knowledge of the cosmos and incorporate that into our sort of collective knowledges in humanity in general.
Well, I mean, okay, now I have a better framework for some of the things that you believe. I think on some level you may have done a different job is I think you still have the hope of empiricism to some degree and the hope of scientific collaboration in that sense.
Well, I don't know. I think there's certain elements. I know the astrologers supposedly did the scientific tests during it was pretty much just like the 1960s, the 1970s and 80s. Like when I came to the astrological community and realized the level to which most astrologers don't know anything about the history of astrology. Most astrologers don't know where the techniques come from or how they're originally developed. Most astrologers don't have any background in science or scientific training. They have very little background in other fields of astrology or other approaches to astrology besides their own. When I think about those groups of people being the ones, you know, collaborating with the scientists, or in some instances being the ones doing their own scientific testing in the 1970s and 80s, that does not fill me with a lot of hope or a lot of confidence that we gave it our best shot in the 1970s and 80s. Now, you know, I still agree with, to some extent, and I understand the counter arguments that came out of the failure of those tests in the 1990s, such as Jeffrey Cornelius's, you know, complete, essentially rejection, saying that astrology is not a science and we shouldn't even attempt to test it scientifically. But I still think there might be some possibilities there that have not been looked into, where even if astrology is not completely on that level, where there could be some small pieces of it that could be demonstrated or validated in some way. And I don't have confidence that we sort of gave it our best shot a few decades ago before everybody gave up.
Yeah, and I'm more in Cornelius's school of thought, but this is a point where you and I may also collude and connect rather than collide. My thought process on this is that if there is any hope in terms of marrying more science scientific empiricism, because I mean, we have already clarified that there is a way in which some aspect of astrology is empirical in a broad sense of it. But if there's any hope of scientific empiricism, I think we may end up looking at a very different astrology than how we currently understand it. Whether that becomes like, if we're using houses, you know, and using some aspect of the chart idea, whether that becomes Gauklin centers or sectors, or whether that also, you know, especially with some of the research that David Cochran is stepping into and other harmonic astrologers like David Hamlin, you know, if they're looking at the data and looking at data, it's going to be more along the spectrum of harmonics. And, you know, I do incorporate harmonics into my practice. I even teach important, like I teach aspects before I teach houses to my students. And that comes from where I see more stronger, consistent correlations with aspects than I see in terms of the interpretation and the emphasis on houses. That doesn't mean I don't pay attention or use houses. I do. But I just think we may end up seeing a very different notion of astrology. And astrology is a lot more robust and flexible in its understanding than we might recognize, you know. And I think that may have been the problem also with the modern astrologer from the 70s and the 80s, is that they didn't fully understand and recognize the fluidity. Something as simple like you could look at the part of fortune and look at the second house from the part of fortune and it have interpretive measure. That kind of fluidity of understanding of what second house signifies, whether it's from the ascendant or from the part of fortune, is not something that our immediate predecessors had.
Right. Yeah. I mean, astrology has grown and changed a lot just in the past few decades, mm-hmm. and our understanding right. of it has developed a lot. And that's, you know, important because it's also coming out of, you know, those few decades, it was coming out of that low point after a couple of centuries where it largely stopped being practiced by professionals and fell out of academia and everything else. And so it was recovered and revived through the New Age community, through this Theosophical Society, and, you know, basically religious individuals like that initially in the early 20th century, and then eventually becomes popular with the counterculture movement and like the hippies and some of the New Age movement in the 1960s and 70s. But it's like, I don't know, those were steps that were being taken in the revival of astrology, and there's still work that's being done now in order to really, you know, we're having a debate right now even about the nature of astrology and the extent to which it's, you know, objectively valid, or to the extent to which it's based on empiricism. And if astrologers are still having debates like that, it's not like all things will be resolved or that we'll cease to have debates at some point in the not too distant future. Sure. But if we're still debating very basic things like that, then certainly we still have a lot more that we have to get together before, you know, demonstrating or attempting to put astrology on a more solid footing and validate it in society is really going to happen or be very effective.
Well, that's where I think, I don't know if I completely agree with that. I think there are ways in which, you know, we can establish a different meaning. You know, one thing, you know, one source of inspiration I have, you know, and I understand some of your, you know, pullback or even resistance, pushback even, in terms of looking at astrology as literature, related to literature. And I think also this was something Austin mentioned and had some issue with. Some source of inspiration for me is, you know, the pragmatist Richard Rorty. I don't know if you're familiar with Richard Rorty. He's a pragmatist, somewhat along the spectrum of the American pragmatist William James, but he was a thinker from pretty much, you know, the 80s. You know, I wouldn't say he was influenced by postmodern thought, but he definitely had like some connection to the sensibility. Long story short, he's a philosopher who left the philosophy department to go into literature. And where I've drawn some measure of inspiration from Rorty is that he saw the real test of philosophy through literature. Because musing about philosophy in complete abstraction and separated from aspects of literature, really, he argued, was more of a private enterprise than something that was public. And so his whole thing was how to broaden public discourse. And I think that's one of the things that astrologers really are struggling with. because it has an insularity, you know, not just in terms of who's in astrology, but it has an insularity in terms of, you know, its history, whether it's like this esoteric science and esoteric art, or whether it's something that's influenced by something that we can look at publicly, whether it's like collecting a lot of data, whether it's open to the public and its discourse, and it struggles with that in terms of figuring out where's the public arena in which we have a conversation about it. But philosophy has definitely changed because of people like Richard Rorty, where it's become much more robust in terms of where it engages, you know, the idea of the public intellectual. It engages even ideas of philosophy. So it does it in terms of politics. It does it in terms of literature. It does it in terms of all these different things that was not the traditional province of philosophy. And it wasn't just, you know, and philosophers were clouded by arguments and debates within it, you know, whether we're empiricists, whether we're going along, you know, Hume thought or Schopenhauer, or how we're looking at things in terms of Kierkegaard. So, but it's kind of come to a little more of its own without worrying about the resolution of all its previous arguments. I think astrology is vast enough to be able to accommodate that without feeling like we have to get our stuff together in order to kind of face the big dragon of empiricism or scientific empiricism. I don't think that has to be true.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we're rapidly getting things together and seeing astrology move in the directions that it has been really positive and really heartening. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, so I guess maybe some of our final points here should just be, you know, did you learn anything from this experience of going on that show that either you'll do differently in the future if hypothetically, I mean, it's unlikely, but if hypothetically you were to do it again, or if there's somebody listening to this show right now that, you know, hears this, that maybe ends up in a similar position in the future, you know, advice that you would give them in terms of how to
sure.
do it.
I think, you know, some measure, I'm calling it the melancholic dry approach, I think is important to kind of give, to really hear the subtext. And I don't think, you know, I was going along with the point I wanted to make about science and not the point that challenges what the scientist or the scientific evangelist was trying to say. So I think it would be going in knowing that you're going to have to deal with the assumptions that one, someone thinks astrology is bogus, that you're just fleecing people, and it's all confirmation bias, and that it has no real validity. The key thing is to debunk the idea of validity. And there's a couple of different ways you can do that. You can do it the way you were talking about it, which is, you know, from observable phenomenon that we don't fully understand. And so you believe that at some point we will come to something. And, you know, there are many people who share this. You know, my friend Robert and your friend Robert Curry is one of those people who believes that we will come to a point where we can better understand this crazy, odd phenomenon that we call astrology in a way that does align itself better to some of the ideas of science. Again, I don't have your faith, but I do believe that that is one way to debunk the idea that it has no validity. But I think another way is to question how we really establish validity, which is what I was trying to do. Now, it may have been too much of a big journey to kind of make in a short period of time, but that's what I was trying to do. I think the other things are important is to, you know, really deal with the other things that people are going to say, like, oh, you're just fleecing people. And not to step into the trap, like, or never to step in the trap. And I think, you know, I guess you'll give me some measure of kudos for this. No one should ever step in the trap of trying to prove astrology on the spot. Never, ever fall for that. And that's one thing someone will try. Like, well, let me give you my data and you see what, you know, you say about me. Or, well, let's pull someone from the audience and you can do it. You will not win.
Yeah.
There's no way you can. There's no way you can win. So, I mean, I knew I was ready for that trap, but do not ever step into that because that's one of the things they may try.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like a parlor trick or something like that, that you whip out, and that right. typically doesn't.
But you may even think like, well, yeah, you can't be cocky enough to think like, oh, well, I can look at someone's chart. You know, the problem is you can't vouch for who's going to be honest. You might say something that really is spot on, but it's like, oh, that's pretty general. Isn't everyone, you know, so you never have any room, even when you're very specific. And the more you might be trying to be specific, you can't tell whether you're feeling the pressure to be specific because, you know, you're on a radio show or a television show, or because you're really kind of reading it correctly. So if someone has a Mercury Saturn square, and to kind of say, like, you may have had trouble speaking when you were younger, that may absolutely be provably false. And that may not be the manifestation of the Mercury Saturn square. But you could talk about particular manifestations. But again, I would stay away from it completely. On the spot readings. Let me see if there's anything else. One thing I will say, and I talked about this with you, is, you know, people who work behind the scenes may have really good intentions to have an open conversation. But when you get on the show and the cameras go live and they're flashing the red lights, everything changes. So just be prepared for that. Even when someone is receptive to you. I mean, I went on a show recently and a TV show, not Bill Nye, and they wanted me to talk about, you know, things that were happening with the Venus retrograde and whatever. So that was what I talked about with the producer. When it ended up like, well, talk to us about Leo. I couldn't even start from going through Aries through Pisces. There's like, no, let's start with Leo. So, and I, and, you know, luckily I had some thoughts in my mind for each of the signs that I had rehearsed pretty cleanly and clearly to be able to have sound bites for that. But just because a producer or a set of producers say one thing, be prepared for the fact that it may become a different thing when the actual media gets on. Because the problem with astrologers engaging the media is that they, you know, they do have a sort of agenda, which is more soundbite. So the only way in which we can completely convey the aspect of our art is when we have a good amount of time. I did think we were going to have, you know, a full 15 minutes. I did not know that we were going to have, I was going to be dealing with three people. I knew there was going to, you know, there was a talk of maybe of a panel, but it was just going to be like the two of us and then moderating with Bill. But it turned out to be like 3-on-1. So I didn't have even enough time to kind of, or I didn't even feel like I had enough time to kind of expand on my points. So those are some things I concretely
learned. Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, maybe to the extent, I mean, one of the things that's interesting that I observed just in terms of the three panelists is like, they weren't necessarily people that specialized in astrology or had any background in the subject. They were just people that were good at talking about broader issues dealing with science and skepticism and sort of broad sort of accusations or issues to take with pseudoscience. And even Bill Nye himself, of course, his main thing was just getting in some of those pretty common statements and pretty common accusations about astrology. And maybe one of the things that astrologers that we need to do a better job of developing is just very concise responses to, you know, if they say this, like, what is your concise response to that that accurately and adequately refutes the point? You know, if they say, you know, you're just, you got in that to this just to rip people off, you say, you know, no, I actually got into it because I was surprised that it seems to work and I found it interesting and decided to keep studying it. And eventually it became the primary thing that I do or whatever. So just the developing right. Like concise, each astrologer may be thinking about some of these questions that were posed to you or thinking about other questions that come from skeptics and how you would respond to those if you were put on the spot and thought you only had, you know, a couple of sentences to respond.
And that's true. I mean, that's kind of the thing to realize. You will only have seconds.
Right. And to know not just, you know, how to make an argument or how to respond with how you would sort of say it, but also how that person's going to hear it or what they're going to hear based on what you say. And I think that's the main thing we've been talking about for most of this episode is just the difference sometimes between, you know, if you had a chance to make your full argument, how you would say it and how you'd articulate it versus, you know, what that other person is going to hear when you use certain words and whether those words are going to have the intended effect or whether the person's going to interpret them maybe slightly differently than what you intend.
All right. Or if you, like me, have a slightly different point, realize that you're going to have to pick and choose very carefully how you might even come to develop that point, or if you have enough time. Again, I mean, I am comfortable still with saying astrology as an art because that's what I believe. But I definitely would make the point that, you know, art or even things that are not scientific still can have validity. And I think the key word to kind of throw in is validity. So the thing that I do feel bad about, if people heard from that, from the show, or even people who are, you know, rooting for astrology, that I don't think it's really valid, then that's not what I meant at all.
Sure.
Because I do believe it's valid.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, and that's the main point that I wanted to talk about, just to give you a chance to clarify that point and expand on some of those. So I'm glad we got a chance to have this discussion.
Me too. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show. You're going to, I guess I'll see you in a couple of weeks at Norwalk, right?
That's right.
Awesome. And people can find out more information about your website, which is at unlockastrology.com, right?
That's correct. And if they want to reach me directly, it's, you know, by email. The easiest way is unlockastrology, all one word, at gmail.com.
Okay, perfect. All right. Well, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Chris. And I'm glad we had a good, passionate conversation during this full moon. So it's cool.
Yeah, full moon in Scorpio, a couple of Scorpio sun people. I think it was fitting. We got 2 hours in, so we'll save the rest for next time. And I'm sure we'll be back again for more before too long.
All right. Thank you.
All right. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next time.